The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Fanta Av, and I work on main campus. I'm the Assistant Vice President of Campus Life and also the Director of the International Student Scholar Services Office here at American University. I'm going to let each of the panelists quickly introduce themselves, and then we're going to get started.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Sandra Butrón. I'm the Director of Graduate Career and Professional Development at Georgetown University Law Center. And just to be completely true, my title basically means that I'm the LLM Career Advisor. So for the Masters of Laws that are in the law school, we have close to 500 to 550, both U.S. and foreign trained.
You all have seen me already, but to reintroduce myself, I'm Myra Wilder. I'm the Senior Academic Counselor here at American University Washington College of Law, and I am the person responsible for implementing accommodations for all students, JD as well as LLM.
Great. Well, the title of our session, I think it's quite appropriate the way it's been framed. It's called the International Law Student Culture, Access, and When We'll Stop Scrambling. And I think the last part of it is the operative word, scrambling. By and large, what we're going to attempt to do today is really to provide some framework for you, but after that, really give ample time for us to engage in a discussion about what you're observing on your respective campuses, and perhaps what might be some of the strategies that we've learned working with students who are coming to us from pretty much all around the world and with various forms of disabilities. As the Director of the International Student Scholar Services Office, one of the things that I have seen, the first encounter I had with specifically trying to look at accommodation issues and looking at issues of culture and access was probably about 20 years ago when the first student from Argentina came to American University when I first started working in the office. And as a student then, this was a blind student who came to American and had a dog with him to help him out. Needless to say, that was the first time that on main campus we had encountered that specific situation, and it took literally, as we say in my part of the world, it took a village. And so first and foremost, to get us started, I think it's safe to say, in order to do this and to do this well, it really does take a village. And we'll give you examples after examples of how that plays out. Why is this issue important? Even if on your campus you've only encountered one or two students who've come to you, international students in need of accommodation, what I can assure you is that this is going to be a growing trend. And let me tell you a little bit about why this is a growing trend. By and large, with sponsoring organizations and primarily with U.S. government agencies, whether it's the Fulbright program, whether it's the Humphreys program, whether it's the IREX program, pretty much every single major exchange visitor program is making a commitment to diversify the international students that they're bringing to the United States. And the commitment is around two major fronts. First and foremost, they're making a commitment to make sure that there's greater representation among these major flagship programs of students from underrepresented backgrounds. So now more and more Fulbright commissions around the world are leaving the capitals of the world and are going to more remote areas to try to recruit students in distant places beyond the capital to ensure that there's more socioeconomic diversity. In addition, there's been a growing commitment to diversifying along disability and issues of access. And so as a result, as more government programs are moving in that direction, it will translate in more students coming our way with different forms of disabilities that are being supported through either the U.S. government or in some instances are being supported through their own government. Just recently on main campus, one of our faculty members who worked in the School of International Service just received a $9 million grant from the Nippon Foundation to put together a disability access program for the ASEAN countries, with the understanding that students from around the ASEAN countries will be able to take courses through distance education, and as a result of that, that this will help to permeate the larger societal framework and will allow more and more people from different communities to be able to function fully and to be full citizens within their community. So one is there's a growing trend. There's funding that is being put specifically toward meeting this goal. A second reason for why we will be seeing more students coming our way, and also more scholars, by the way, research scholars and others coming our way from international background, is that there are more participants with passion for social justice and disability rights. Many times the students who would be coming to your law programs, the students who would be coming even to main campus for various programs, often come to our programs with a passion and a deep belief in social justice, particularly around disability rights. Many of them study disability rights with the understanding that they'll be able to go back to their societies and will be able to make fundamental changes within legal frameworks, within social frameworks, etc. That's another reason why there's a growing trend. So with that said, what do we know about the situation, and more importantly, why does this matter? Being on campus and being in charge of the International Student Scholar Services Office, I think perhaps the best way for me to describe my role is to many times be a cross-cultural mediator. And in that sense is to work with the academic units, is to work with sponsoring organizations, to work with various departments and programs to see how can we work collectively in order to ensure that the students and the scholars who are coming to us are going to be able to take full advantage of the learning that they are coming for, and more importantly, that they're going to be successful in their programs. And there's several challenges that we have encountered along the way. One, first and foremost, is balancing expectations and needs. In the US, you tend to work from a cultural framework of independence. Much of the world works from a framework of interdependence. And when it comes specifically to the area of student, when it comes specifically to students who come to us with disabilities, and when it comes to international students in general, there is a very quick tension between a value system of independence and a value system of interdependence. This is where often we start to see some of the friction. A second element that often comes up in terms of some of the cultural dynamics is around language and how language gets, and the meaning around different forms of languages. Many of the students who come with disabilities often come from cultures where for the longest period of time, the way they've been able to be successful is through family support network. They leave that support network and come to us. The first thing that they often understand has been lost is that social network. And the first thing they look for is to find substitute for that social network. So the question that often comes up is, what would that social network look like? Who would take responsibility for that social network? And how does it play out in a different cultural context? So second element is the social network piece of the work. The third piece having to do with communication. All too often, there is breakdown in intercultural communication. With the best of intentions and with the best of work that's put into it, we often find that we have to spend more time, we have to reframe differently in order to be able to sort of navigate perhaps what might be some of the cross-cultural misunderstandings that often take place within the context that we're in. So with that said, what I wanted to talk to you a little bit about are a couple of elements. One is the reason why the scrambling happens is that all too often I think institutions will say we don't have enough information, particularly when we're working with the sponsoring organizations. We may find out that there's a student coming to us with a disability, but beyond that, we may not have the appropriate accommodation papers, and Myra will talk to you a little bit more about in her work what she often has to do in order to accommodate the student. So first point is I think we need to think about more creatively how to ensure that communication is smoother before students get here, and perhaps need to spend more time with the sponsoring organizations to talk to them about our expectations, but also to understand their expectations. That would probably be one of the first things. The second element has to do with the fact that once students actually get here, I think it's safe to say that for all students, they're often overwhelmed. But I can certainly say that for students coming with other challenges, they're certainly even more overwhelmed. And often we find that we have to spend a lot more time. Often we find that we need to bring in folks who can perhaps play a mediating role when needed, because in many cultures, again, that might be an appropriate way in which to address issues as they come up. ultimately, at the end of the day, with the number of students that we have who have come to American, one of the things that I think I can say safely is that what has been, I think, a successful model has been the teamwork. It's been the ongoing communication between the programs and my office, and particularly also with the disability support services, working in tandem to make sure that we are communicating the same message to students, but also placing the work in a context and in a cultural context that is relevant and that is understandable and is accessible to the student in order for them to succeed. And so a couple of things that I have found have been useful in my work. First and foremost, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. There are lots of lessons that we learn along the way, and those lessons help us to be able to navigate successfully. The second piece of not reinventing the wheel is that, luckily here in the U.S., there's so much good information around particularly disability and access and accommodation. But one of the key websites that I have gone to and one of the key resources that I have worked closely with has been the Chief Executive Officer of the Mobility International USA. She has been probably one of the folks that I've had on speed dial when I've needed to. I have gone to their website again and again because I have found really key resources that she's made available and her team have made available. For example, there's a clearinghouse for Mobility International, and there are tons of resources on that site. Second of all, on the site, there is a link on cultural differences related to disabilities. It has been very well written, and it's been written particularly from the numerous voices of students and scholars who've had to navigate the system and who therefore tell their stories and provide invaluable lessons to the work that we do. The third element that I have found to be probably the most useful element, and this was really recent that I came across this, recent as literally in about just a month or so ago, is that there are numerous forms that are intake forms that are available related to different types of disabilities. And one of the things that I certainly will recommend to the team here at American is that we probably need to use those templates. And prior to students getting here, making sure that we ask these very key questions to help us figure out ahead of time how to ensure that we have all the information that we need to be able to appropriately help students and not feel like we have to scramble at the last minute. The fourth thing that is on the website that I also thought was invaluable is that there are lots of resources for the students themselves and exchange visitors. Because I think the more we can communicate and educate students about what are the access resources, what are some of the resources that exist around disabilities, particularly in the U.S., that helps them to contextualize it in a way that I think will help all of us. And probably it would be useful to us to send some of that information ahead of time so students can anticipate a little bit better what the transition would look like so that in coming in, it's not that they're going to come in with less cultural adjustment or culture shock, but they're going to be better prepared psychologically for the experience itself. I have copies of the resource information that I mentioned and the links. We will make sure to distribute that at the end of the session. But I wanted to start there, and really I want to make sure we have ample time for questions and for discussion. So I'm going to have Myra talk a little bit about the case studies that she's had to work with.
Well, we had one particular case study this summer. Just to give you some background, we have an LLM program here at WCL. It's International Legal Studies Program, and that program has both foreign-trained attorneys as well as U.S.-trained attorneys who are enrolled in it. But the majority of the enrollees in that program are individuals who are attorneys outside of the United States. With that, we attract students from all over the world, from Africa, Europe, Asia. I think we have some Australians in the program as well. And so obviously there are many cultural differences and cultural aspects that come along with these students coming to the United States, many of whom have never been to the United States before, and this is their first exposure to it. And coming to a city like Washington, D.C. can be, as Fonta said, can be complete culture shock. But the particular case that I wanted to discuss is a student from Africa. The student was diagnosed with polio at a very young age. A student is a wheelchair user. And there were a lot of things that myself, as well as multiple individuals within this university, had to do to help this student obtain housing, in particular, when he arrived. And one of the things that Fonta mentioned was language. And I want to kind of key in on the term accommodation. When we say accommodations as student service professionals, we're thinking about the accommodations that students receive within the classroom or during the exam period. So additional time, use of assistive technology, note takers, whatever the student needs based on his or her disability. This student, when he was speaking about accommodation, he was speaking about where he was going to live. And so when the student sent an email to our Disability Support Services office on main campus, he said, I'm seeking accommodations. Well, the first thing that the Disability Support Service director thought, oh, well, you know, he's looking for accommodations in the classroom. No, he wanted to receive accommodations for housing. And the student assumed that because we are a university in Washington, D.C., that we had automatic housing for A, graduate students, and B, for students with disabilities, which is not the case at AU. So there was that kind of got the wheels turning for all of us once we found out that what he meant was, I need a place to live. And then when we learned more about his specific needs, he needed, obviously because he is a wheelchair user, he needed an apartment that had enough space, that had doors that were wide enough for him to use. He needed a bathroom with a roll-in shower. He needed countertops that were lower. He needed numerous things. And D.C. is a wonderful city. I love it, you know, but housing in D.C. for individual disabilities is not easy to come by. And so, and I'm sure that's the case in many other cities and towns across the United States. So for us, we had to pool every single resource that we could possibly find to help this student find housing. One of the things that was difficult was that the student was being sponsored through a foundation. And so funding for this student was also very limited, which you're going to find with many international students. They don't have, you know, open pockets to just spend thousands of dollars a month on rent, especially in a city like D.C. that's quite expensive. And so we knew what the student's limit was in terms of how much he could spend on rent. And for what he needed in terms of space, coupled with what he was paying, you know, what he could pay for rent, the two were not matching up. What he needed was going to cost much more than what he actually had to spend. And so, therefore, we had to start getting the wheels turning and thinking of alternatives in terms of, okay, well, maybe we can go this route. Maybe we can go this route. Obviously, an apartment complex is probably not going to be the best way to go because sometimes they don't have the space that the student needs. And on the flip side of that, the foundation who was sponsoring him, you know, he needed additional things. So he needed, extenders to open shelves. He needed, special amenities for the bathroom. And that's money. In addition, the student also needed an electric wheelchair because the wheelchair that he was utilizing at home, he was being pushed around by, you know, whomever was working with him. And as Fonta said, it takes a village for him. His family, his friends, his village were the people who helped him with his daily tasks. And when he came here, he wasn't going to get that, obviously. So the difficult part for us was funding and finding the resources using the resources that we could to help this student get what he needed. Ultimately, after I would say probably almost 2 months of calling and using listservs and reaching out to faculty members and reaching out to, you know, independent living organizations within the city and using every single disability resource guide that we could find. Ironically, an adjunct faculty member who teaches legal English in the summer went to the associate director of our international legal studies program, who was also a part of this search, and said, there is an assisted living community near the university that rents apartments to individuals with disabilities. They don't have to be 55 or over, because it was a 55 or over community. If they qualify, they can live in the building, and the rent was within what he could spend. And that's how we found housing for him, 2 months later. So, you know, and I think this was maybe a month before school started or something, like 3 weeks before school started. So I say all that to say that, you know, it's not an easy task. It's not a quick task. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. And if, you know, for us, luckily, the student reached out to us early enough so that we could get this process started. But if he had not done that and, you know, sent us an email the week before classes started, it, you know, he may not have found housing until September or October into the school year. And so it's very important for us who are in disability support offices and student service professionals who do work with international students with disabilities to be prepared for the amount of time that it's going to take to assist the student in whatever he or she needs, whether it's housing, whether it's, you know, a lot of international students are not, and I want to say a lot, but many of them are not very familiar with some of the, you know, technology that we use here in schools. And we can't make assumptions that they know things because they may or they may not. It may not be something that they have access to in their home countries. And so you have to go in there kind of with an open mind and an open slate, if you will, because anything can happen at any moment. And you just have to be patient, number one. Patience is a virtue in this entire process. And you have to be able to kind of walk side by side with the student and never make the student, this is critical, never make the student feel like he or she is being a burden on you, because especially, again, for international students who may not be very familiar with the culture and they may feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm just a burden. Whatever, leave it alone. I'll deal with it. I'll do it on my own. And a lot of times they can't do it on their own. So just always be supportive of them and tell them that in the end everything's going to work out fine, but this is not a process that takes, you know, a week or two. It could take up to, in our case, almost 3 months.
And looking at that case study, one of the invaluable lessons that I think was learned from that, along with several other case studies that come to mind, is that, as I said before, with programs like Fulbright, IREX, and the range of programs, we are seeing an increase in the number of international students who are coming through those programs with various forms of disabilities. But what we also found out through that process is that the selection process for those students happens locally with the commissions on the ground. And all too often, those commissions on the ground have very little context for what is happening on the ground here in the U.S. And so in this specific instance, the breakdown in communication took place, particularly around what type of information needed to be communicated, and more importantly, what was the specific of the case that needed to be communicated earlier on, was certainly one of the lessons that was learned, and that I think will continue to be a lesson to be learned, particularly by the sponsoring organization. The second thing that I think we learned from that was the need for us as an institution to play an advocacy role with the sponsoring organization. That is where I spend a lot of my time in these instances, is being on the phone with the sponsoring organizations to really talk more about our expectations, but more importantly, to talk about how they can continue to work with us in partnership to ensure that this student is successful. Because the funding needs to be coming from them. And so generally, it takes a lot of negotiation back and forth to be able to get to that comfortable place with the sponsoring organization and with the student. The third element of lesson that was learned there, and I think Myra touched on it, is really helping students to become self-advocates. That takes time, but it's also an important lesson. Because often what the students will expect, they will expect that when it comes to housing accommodation, then of course the university will work with me on that. But when it comes to other forms of accommodations, because they come from societies where it's literally non-existent, they have very low expectations of what is even feasible or what they can even expect. And so helping them to become better self-advocates is certainly one of the lessons that often we have to spend time with them on to make sure that things are not falling through the cracks.
When I was thinking, what am I going to say in this panel, And first of all, thank you, David Jaffe, who's not in the audience, but thank you for organizing this conference. I've come every year, and I think it's an amazing resource for us, as you heard me say at the beginning of the panel. I'm a career advisor. And if you read my bio, I'm a foreign trade attorney myself. So I'm one of the few, I guess, that is a foreign trade attorney that actually changed careers, which in my country is not something that it's actually something that you would do typically. In fact, my job doesn't even exist in my country. So whenever I went back after I got this job, I started here at AU, I always had to explain what I did. So I can relay this information to the students, disabled or not disabled, that are foreign, because just the simple fact that you have an accent makes you different than the rest of the people. I am a lawyer. I am not a counselor. And I've done this for many, many years. I think I have, like many of you, I see seasoned career advisors in the audience, people that I actually have contacted and have helped me help my students. We all of us here, the employers that are represented and the people from universities that are represented here in this conference, we all do this, whatever your job is, because we like people and we like interacting with other human beings, and we want to help. Let me start by telling you my first experience with a foreign trained LLM student that has had a disability, and he was here. His name, I will never forget, Gideon Mandesi from Tanzania. He was an amazing person, you know, a person that that the school and David and everybody else helped get all the accommodations and so he was on his way. It was very interesting to see how he left going to a school that is in the middle of a residential area like this one. It's more problematic, because if you're in GW here in town, where it's outside and you can take a taxi or go to the metro very easily, things are a little bit easier. So it was very interesting, because they had LLM students, foreign LLM students, that would read to him. And one of them was in a career advising counseling session with me, and she said, you know, let me explain what I'm doing for the school. You know, we career advisors want to know so that we can help you flesh out things on your resume. And she was saying, I'm a reader for Gideon, and we all knew who he was. And she said, you know, I am learning so much from him. It's not only what I'm learning in the legal common law system, but it's what I'm learning from having that interaction with him. You know that I have to read, he's writing a paper, because he has to fulfill his duties as a student like everybody else. And I'm reading a quote from a book that he's quoting in his paper, and I said, thing that I'm quoting is on page, for the sake of this conversation, is on page 10. And Gideon says to her, no, that is not on page 10, it's on page 11. And she started, you know, no, it's on page 10. Go to the book and read page 11. And guess what? It was on page 11. You know, I learned that day that there's no difference, and that's the first lesson that I learned, because what we agree that I was going to talk about here are the lessons learned in dealing with students that are from other countries that have disabilities. First, don't underestimate the power of who they are as humans. Yes, they have a disability, but guess what? We sort of relate those people that have accents. And even within the United States, there are people that have accents. If they come from the South to Washington, D.C., people look at you, you have an accent. So, you know, and you say that, and that is exactly the reaction that you get. You're breaking the ice with your student, and that would be the first thing. The second thing is what I said about myself. These positions that we all have represented in this audience do not exist in other countries. And I hope that, you know, I've been out of practice in Panama for 12 years, so I hope that things are starting to be as, I don't think they're ever going to be the way that they are in the United States, but that things are happening in other countries. So it's this education, and take it as the best experience that you would ever have, because you're learning from the person, and in order for you to actually help them better navigate through the job process for a position here within the United States, be an intern or externship, which is an internship for credit, or a position outside the country, you need to start developing that relationship with that person and ask them questions. You know, they're not going to be offended, and you can say, I don't propose to be a know-it-all of all the things that are happening in the world and all the disabilities. I need to understand who you are. Tell them that you're there to help them, because they don't know. They simply do not know. They do have, and don't have the misconception that many of us have, that because a person comes from Africa, that, Africa is an underdeveloped continent, things are not happening there, because that's not true. So just embrace the fact that you don't know what the person brings with them, and talk to them about it. You know, I am here to help you. I'm here to advocate for you. I'm not going to look for it. I'm going to help you as much as I can. But as I want to be fair with all my students, I don't have a job waiting for you. I just want to have this conversation with you so that we can figure out where to guide you. This morning, in both panels, people were talking about networking. For anybody who moves to Washington, D.C., and this is part of the process of telling your students that have a disability, you know, anybody who comes to Washington, disabled or not, with an accident or not, you start fresh. You don't know anybody, and it's just a matter of going out there and meeting people. Explain the concept of networking, because it's very interesting. This is the most expensive gift, education, for 10 months in an LLM program in this country, is the most expensive gift that some of your students and some of the people that you meet that are LLMs are giving to themselves. Because education, in all the years that they went to high school, primary school, secondary school, and university, has never cost as much as 1 year in the United States. So they have to take advantage, and sometimes you have to... It's the same thing that we do with all the foreign students, by the way. You have to remind them, this is a gift that you give yourself. And obviously, for what Fanta and Myra are saying, some of these gifts are funded by other people, but you were the one who had the prerogative of saying, yes, I'm going, or no, I'm not going, and you decided to come. So talk to them about the importance of networking. Some of them don't have much of a knowledge. They heard the word mentorship, which the panelists previous to us have mentioned several times. Explain that to them and tell them, you know, recruit people from the alumni office. I think what I found very interesting in working in two academic institutions in this country is that going and putting yourself out there, we cannot tell students if we're career advisors, we cannot tell students to network if we don't do it ourselves in the places where we are. So if you have a good network of conversations with people that are involved in the life of your students, you would have those resources readily available. In Washington, D.C., I love Sherry's story about the person who opened the can for her, because how many times that happens all over this country? You're sitting in a train and you talk to somebody and you're feeling the same pain and anguish, when are we going to get there, when are we going to get there? And you never know who you're talking with. So that part of the process, those things happen in this country. And people are going to, you know, you can talk to them also about the fact, and we came up with a good list of, what we think is a good list of resources that you can use. They need to start getting trained themselves so that they can prepare for the job search process. Talk to them about the EEOC. And in the United States, everybody speaks with acronyms. So at the beginning, you have to explain what the acronym is, and then you can use it on a regular basis. We do love ILS, and what is that? And WCL, and, you know, the same thing, EEOC, ADA. And so it's part of the education process. They need to know what that is. They need to know about the American Bar Association. They have a commission, and I want to read it because I don't want to... Commission on Mental and Physical Disability Laws that has a list of employers who have signed a disability diversity pledge. Obviously, they signed it for U.S. trained attorneys, but I've been known, and I know my colleagues in career advising, been known to pick up the phone and call people. You know, don't underestimate the power of pushing your student to call their embassy or consulate, even if they're in a state very far from Washington or New York, California, where are the quintessential states where you have these representations. For what, they would ask you, so that you can actually tell them if there's an opportunity, if you hear of anybody who's looking for somebody who's doing this type of practice, you know that I'm here and I'm a national of your country. In law firms, there's a disabilities coordinator. And, you know, in the process of letting them know of all these things that are available in the United States for people with disabilities, that's actually a conversation that you have to have. I don't think anybody, we talk about expectations, but I think I'm a big believer and proponent that if you give enough information to people, they would before they come, they would know what to expect. When we prepare for the LLMs to come from other states and other countries, we send them a lot of information and tell them there's no job for every single one of you 500 people, but it's on you. It's your responsibility. You have to advocate for yourself. And many of them already have those skills. What do we do when we are telling people to put things on their resumes? We're telling them to list their transferable skills, their skills that they acquire in all the different positions that they have so that they can actually use them in the new position. So even that is part of your process of teaching them. You know, the process of you explaining your disability or the process of you navigating the job search process in somewhere else in the world might be something that you might want to put in on your resume, not all the time, but with the conversation that they're going to have with you and with the academic advisor sometimes, it's actually a very good exercise. Basically, I'm just to define it the way that we do here, is tell them to do an introspective examination of themselves. Self-assessment, 10 questions. What are the skills that you bring to the table? What are the skills that you think you're gonna be able to provide to an employer? There's not that much difference between your career advising a student that doesn't have a disability and a student that has one. We had a student at Georgetown. Yeah, we had a student at Georgetown that unfortunately she had to have 2 surgeries and she had to delay her timing in the United States. And we always ask her, I think it's part of the openness in the line of communications, they have to tell you how you're going to help them. And when she went to interviews, we asked her, do you want us to call the interviewer or the recruiter in advance? And she said she didn't. And we respect that. In fact, she went and she already had, her whole life she has this disability. So she knew exactly what she wanted to say. And she was a very well-spoken person. You know, I know that you mentioned the language, but I have to say that it's not 100% true for every single person that you're going to meet. Yes, there are language barriers, but don't start with that premise, because if you're going to consider every single person that comes from outside the United States, person that has a language barrier, then you're starting with the wrong foot. Just start fresh. That would be my last thing, and I'm not going to. Start fresh. This is a new person, a new individual, and as such, they should be treated.
We want to open up to questions, comments, reactions. What are you observing in your part of the world? And
I'd like some sort of input from all of you regarding how you deal with the student with a known diagnosis of disability who comes with no documentation in terms of determining eligibility issues, and also how you deal with the student who, because of perhaps some cultural issues in their home country, there's a lack of acknowledgement of certain behaviors or certain needs as meeting a diagnosis of a disability. And so they come with the notion that they're struggling. You may encounter them somewhere throughout that process of study, and there are concerns about their performance, and there's a suspicion that there may be some undiagnosed issue here. Mm-hmm. How do you then deal with the student's need to acquire some documentation that you can then work with in determining reasonable accommodations.
Sure. And I'll let everyone sort of take this on as well. I certainly, going to the question of the student who has arrived and while they're here, there may be some suspicion perhaps of some disability and the resistance that often you may encounter in working with that student. I think that it's safe to say that for a lot of students who are in that situation, one of the things that I have seen as a consistent pattern is what I call the culture of shame. There is a culture of shame around disability around the world, particularly, and for students primarily who come from elite communities, it's even more pronounced because there's the fear of loss of face for families. And this obsession with loss of face that is very true in many cultures often becomes a trigger for the resistance. So one of the things that we've had to do has been to try to help steer the student away from looking at it as a culture of shame to where in this country it could be seen as a culture of achievement. And so it's helping to shift the paradigm. And so often I've had to sit with the student to begin to talk a little bit about what are some of, how would this be perceived in their home country if in fact it was the case that there's a disability, et cetera, because I think helping to conceptualize it then helps me to find ways to shift that paradigm. That's been one of the ways, and I have found that it takes a couple of sessions, but we can get to that point. That's one of the pieces. And ensuring for the student the confidentiality part of it. Because it's not just shame for family, but it's also shame for community here. Who else is going to know? How is this going to reflect on me? How is this going to reflect on my family? So ensuring confidentiality of that becomes another piece to help steer them in that right direction. Maybe, Myra, you want to talk about when there's no paperwork, how does one move with that?
Well, and this is not something that happens every time, and we were, I guess, fortunate, if you will, in the case that I mentioned earlier. You know, as we all know, we all have documentation guidelines. We're required to have documentation guidelines. And for many of us, that may be a 3, 4, or 5 year, you know, maximum, if you will. And yes, many students are coming from countries where they may have been diagnosed as a child, and once they had that formal diagnosis, they never got retested, or, you know, they just saw the doctor on an informal basis, received whatever medication they needed if they needed medication, and so there's no paper trail that an individual in the United States, if they are being consistently treated for a disability, would have. And I don't know if this is the case for all foundations or sponsoring organizations. They may have a medical sheet, if you will, that the student is required to complete. Now, these medical sheets are usually one page front back. You know, there's not much going on there. For us and for our student that I mentioned earlier, we basically just had to go off of that one page sheet because there was no way that we were going to be able to contact the doctor in the student's home country and find out and receive in a timely manner any documentation, if any documentation existed, and we did not operate under the premise that documentation did exist. I don't know if that's the case for all sponsoring organizations, whether or not. I'm assuming that they probably would have to just to ensure that the student wasn't coming into the country with any sort of, you know, communicable disease or anything like that. But that's probably where you would have to start. And we actually had to request those records and get the student's authorization to do so from the organization because they were not going to hand it over to us voluntarily. And that's another thing that, you know, you have to remember is that these organizations are very, you know, they're very tight-knit. And when we first discussed money and things of that nature, we were not allowed to speak to the student. We had to speak to their foundation officer in the U.S. So you really have to push and push and push to get any, you know, if there's any medical information that organization in particular has, you have to push for that. And then obviously, you know, they'll go through the student and get the student's authorization to release it to you. But generally, you may just have to work off of that one-page sheet. Now, you may have a student coming from a country where they have, you know, great documentation and the student was regularly seen by a physician, and it may be easy in that case, but that's probably more the exception than the norm. So I would recommend, and this is what we've had to do in three cases actually, is we've used that sheet, and then from there when we've sat down with the student for an extensive period of time, explained what accommodations were available, asked the student, you know, without being too intrusive, saying, okay, well, what do you think you're going to need? What are things that when you're sitting in a classroom, what are things that you feel you need? Do you feel like, you know, you need someone to take notes for you? Do you feel like if you have to write that your hand may cramp up, or, you know, and get that information out of the student, and then we base the accommodations for the student mostly based on what the student has told us and through also our counsel. Because a lot of times we can't really go off of what a doctor recommends through documentation because it's non-existent.
The other element of that is that in the cases that I've encountered, where I think Myra is absolutely correct that at least for the sponsoring organization, they all have to fill out a comprehensive medical form. We don't always get it, but it's with the sponsoring organization. The other element also that I think makes it difficult when the students have not come in with a diagnosis and now we think there's something going on and we're trying to sort of assess that, is cost. Cost is a real barrier for a lot of these. I mean, accommodation assessment is extremely expensive. And so I know on main campus we've had to work with our disability support services to see how creative we can be on that front. In some instances, because they have contacts within the community in terms of folks who do assessment, we've had to negotiate a kind of sliding scale. And then sometimes in my office, through development efforts over the years, we have a student an international student emergency fund. And one of the main reasons why for years I worked on trying to create an emergency fund was because I had seen over the years emergency situations that came up where the major deterrent was cost, and where being able to address that would make all the difference in that student experience and their ability to succeed. So it certainly is one of the things that I would also suggest to think about, particularly if you have a sizable number of international students on your campus, to look at alternative sources of funding to help with that.
I would say a couple of things. At Georgetown, at the main campus, Georgetown is actually separated physically from the main campus. They realized that they needed to bring somebody who had counseling background. And so we have a counselor in the staff. So when I heard this, and this goes to my suggestion, is you should know your university ups and downs. You know, up and down, I'm sorry. You should know all the administrators, and in universities that are big, like Georgetown University is, it's a little bit challenging, but I think the first person that I would start with is with the dean of students. We decided that because I'm an advocate for the foreign students, foreign students in universities all over the world don't have this ability to have a person on call there to help them in any shape or form. So we have incorporated in orientation a segment her name is Raya, where Raya comes and talks to them and tells them very much what Fanta has talked about, because we all recognize that there's a cultural issue that has to be addressed. So she not only does it verbally, but she also has a written sort of flyer that the students actually get. The other thing that I would say is that the majority of foreign trained attorneys that you're dealing with, the majority, not all of them, but come from civil law countries where you have a code and you have to follow what the code says, and that's how you apply. So if you give them the tools, you talk to them about the Americans with Disabilities Act that they might not even know that exists, they start documenting themselves. They're lawyers, for God's sake. I mean, and that's how you address it. If the person is reluctant, you're a lawyer, you should know your rights and your duties and responsibilities. And these are the laws that apply, and this is why I'm asking you for this. If you can go back, because they're talking about sponsor students, but what if you're talking about a student who's not sponsored, who has the money to come and they come on their own accord? That's how I would approach it. You know, having a conversation and telling them, this is for your own good. If you read the laws and you send them the laws in advance, you have read the laws, and you should know that this is not because we want to bother you or be nagging you. It's because this is something that every step of the way in the 10 or 12 or however long months you're here in the United States, you're going to need. And I think when you say that, I hope
that the person is reasonable and understands that that's part of their duty and responsibility, not only as a student, but as a lawyer that reads the letter of the law.
Thank you. And I do think Sandra has an excellent point, because being in law schools, you have a certain advantage over other programs, in that you're working with lawyers and you have, in addition to framing it around the cultural context, you can frame it around the legal context as well. You know, are there instances with, you know, putting in motions all of these different strategies, the student makes the decision that they're not going to move forward with an assessment? It has certainly happened. And in that instance, what has often happened with that student is they've struggled long enough that often they either end up not doing as well as they had anticipated, or then they can come back 6 months later and sort of say, okay, I relent. And now I think I'm ready to look at other alternatives because I've exhausted all possibilities at this point.
And to address your question about the cultural issues, if you have websites, as much information as you can have available, don't think that the information is going to be basic. Because it's never basic. Even your U.S. trained attorneys are going to take advantage of that information if they don't even know. But have it in so many, in different ways. That has been sort of my way of dealing with the foreign students. I have handouts galore, and I have a website that has all the information that can be distributed to the world because people access the website, but as much information as you can have. And I think that orientation is your best bet for people to pay attention to these things, even if it's a slight part of your orientation, because they're eager to do well, to be the best student that they can possibly be. So take advantage of orientation. I think it has proven to be very successful for us.
We are kind of out of time. I just one last comment that I'd like to make is going back to the point I made earlier, is that I think if we can start from the premise that even though independence is the critical value system here, but that students from most other parts of the world come from an interdependence model, what you often find is that with the students that you're working with, you may feel like you never get them to the full independence, but that's because that is not their framework. But many of them will say to you by the time they finish with their programs that they probably became more independent throughout this process than they ever were.